This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Everywhere we look around the globe today, it seems as if democratic countries are kind of coming apart at the seams. Increasingly polarized citizens are electing increasingly populist leaders rather than presidents and premiers who pledge loyalty to the international community, world peace, and global institutions. In significant ways, Brexit in England, the Yellow Vest movement in France, the rise of Viktor Orban in Hungary, and the election of Donald Trump in America represent the triumph of nationalism and populism over globalism. So many people in advanced democracies now feel as if they're falling further and further behind, while people at the top of society just get more and more money, prestige, and opportunity. As a candidate and as president, Donald Trump continues to invoke these concerns. Globalists, he says, scoffing, are elitists who care more about their own well-being and international institutions and prestige that go with being in the United Nations or following the rules of the World Trade Organization or doing something with NATO than they do about their fellow citizens who are being left behind. Globalists, he says, believe in open borders and free trade because their quality of life isn't threatened by low-wage migrants or cheap goods produced overseas. Nationalists, on the other hand, says Trump, care about taking care of their countrymen first and foremost, by pulling out of international accords that don't serve American interests, by limiting the type and number of people who can come to the U.S., and by forcing other countries to compete on a level playing field economically. As president, Trump has stuck to his nationalist guns. He's withdrawn from international agreements such as the Paris Climate Accord, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the Iran nuclear deal, and he's restricted immigration and lay tariffs on Chinese goods and stuff from other countries as well. Now, my guest today says that it's absolutely imperative, whether you agree with Trump or nationalists or populists more generally, whether you agree with them or not, it's absolutely imperative to understand and empathize with the concerns of nationalists, both here in the United States as well as in Europe and India. A political scientist by training, Ian Bremmer heads up the Eurasia Group, the world's largest political risk consultancy. He's also the host of the weekly PBS show G-Zero World, which investigates how economics and politics are playing out in a world in which the United States and other major powers, traditional major powers, are retreating in significant ways from the global stage. His most recent book is Us Versus Them, The Failure of Globalism, and it's a bracing, provocative analysis of why political polarization is growing and how we might best address the anger and alienation that is fueling nationalist and populist sentiments around the globe. You know, Ian Bremmer, thanks for talking to Reason.
Sure, Nick.
Good evening. Okay. So your 2018 book, Us Versus Them, is subtitled The Failure of Globalism. Give me the elevator pitch of the book. Who is us? Who's them? And how has globalism failed?
Well, I mean, us and them are the two sides that are increasingly polarized, particularly in democracies all over the world. Who's us and who's them depends on, you know, who the person is you're talking to. But there is an us and there is a them, and it's pretty clear.
And everywhere you see the same kind of Manichaean split of or polarization. Whether it's India, whether it's England, whether it's Russia, maybe not so much, or China, and within America.
I would say the democracies. Okay. So, I mean, really, if you look at all of the BRICS that are non-authoritarian, you have greater divide today inside those societies than at any point, you know, in recent decades. That is also true in almost every advanced industrial democracy, with the exception of Japan.
Where do you rank China in this? Because obviously, and in the book, you talk a lot about how it's a one-party state. It's authoritarian, but it's obviously much less authoritarian than it was under Mao. Is there dissent going on?
It's more authoritarian than it has been over the last couple decades. Okay. I mean, Xi Jinping has consolidated a lot more power. Last March, he got rid of term limits. You know, and they've succeeded economically over the last 40 years. So if you combine authoritarianism, single-party state, control of technology, control of and nudging people to all consume the same message, plus economic success and a growing feeling of national pride and a lot of homogeneity within the population itself. I mean, not for the Tibetans, Lord knows not for the Uyghurs. But if you're Han Chinese, you kind of feel like Xi Jinping's China dream applies to you. Most people do. The average American does not feel today that the American dream applies to them. And I think that that is a pretty significant contrast.
So why aren't we all moving to China then?
Well, I mean, because they're a middle-income country and they're authoritarian, right. And a lot of Chinese indeed want to leave and want to get their cash out. So I would not try to make the suggestion that China's a better system than the U.S.
No, of course not. But I
do think that I would make the argument that our democracy is reasonably broken, and that an increasingly large number of Americans and others in wealthy democracies around the world feel rightly that the system is rigged against them.
So we have us versus them, and those sides change depending on the country or on the democracy, but there, you see them again replicated all over the place. In the United States, that breaks down, you know, Trump called it in the 2016 election between nationalists and globalists.
Yes.
Your book is subtitled The Failure of Globalism. You talk a lot about that. Define globalism.
So I want to be very clear that it is very different from the idea that globalization has failed. I think globalization has been a success. There is enormous wealth that's been generated in the world from globalization. There's downside too, climate change. Not you know, where we're going right now, but globalism is this idea that wealthy democracies, the people inside wealthy democracies, should support and will benefit from the U.S. acting as global policemen, free trade, open borders. And that has worked incredibly well for the global economy. It's worked incredibly well for an emergence of a global middle class. It's worked exceptionally well for the top 10, 1, and 0.1% in the West, but it really hasn't worked for the average American, the average European, the average Canadian, the average Australian.
So let's explain that a little bit more, because one of my follow-up questions was, and it's more about globalization rather than globalism, the way that you just defined it. But last fall, people at Brookings, researchers at Brookings said, you know, for the first time ever, a majority of people on the planet live at the middle class or higher level.
Yeah.
There were earlier intimations of that from previous research as well, which is kind of fucking stupendous, right?
That, it's amazing. You know,
I mean, in our lifetime, I mean, people born in the mid to late 20th century, it's kind of amazing to think not just that people are escaping extreme poverty, but they're actually at the middle class or higher level. And then you say, but then there's a difference in the United States, say in many of the Western countries or the OECD countries or whatever, developed economies, people feel like the system is not working for them, but aren't the majority of people in the United States at the middle class or higher level? And so are we talking about an actual reality in which people's lifestyles and quality of life is declining, or is it more that it has stopped growing at the same rate, or relative to other parts of the world, we don't see the growth that we once took for granted?
Yeah, trajectory matters. So certainly you see on the part of the middle and particularly working class almost across the West, that real wages have been flat, while a global middle class from China, from India, from sub-Saharan Africa, from other countries has been emerging, while the wealthy have done fantastically well in the West. So, I mean, obviously, there's always this going to be a perception of you're doing better than me. And so even though I'm doing better, I'm angry. But the reality is that since the 70s, wages in the U.S. have been pretty stagnant for the working class. Furthermore, we've engaged in a lot of wars, Afghanistan, Iraq. They've failed, and we fought them largely on the back of those same people. They come back. They're not heroes. The Veterans Administration is pretty broken. These are people that did not vote for Hillary or for Jeb. They're voting for Bernie. They're voting for Donald Trump.
Right.
We have a lot of immigration, and the reality is that demographics in the United States have changed pretty dramatically over the past decades. They have in Europe, too. Increasingly, whites will be a minority in the United States. But if you feel like your country and your government hasn't taken care of you, then why are you letting new people in? Especially when increasingly your skill sets don't seem to be very relevant for a lot of the jobs that are out there. And then finally, we have the big elephant, which is technology. The fact that if you are one of these disenfranchised people, you increasingly are only getting messages that are directed towards you in that group. It's very tribal. It is very us versus them.
And that is that if you're not being replaced by unskilled Mexicans, you're being replaced by high-tech robots.
If you're not being replaced, you're certainly being made less valuable. So, you know, intellectual piecework, people driving Uber for individual gigs as opposed to driving for UPS, where the car belongs to the company and you've got insurance, they take care of your tickets, you get a pension. I mean, if you're working for Amazon and you're driving, life is very different for you, right? And we see that, you know, big companies don't have as many employees today as they did 30 years ago.
Or this is famously Uber is the world's largest taxi company without owning a single vehicle.
Right.
Airbnb is the world's largest hotelier and they don't own any properties, things like that.
And Amazon is probably the biggest example of this. And it's not as if they don't employ any people, but most of the people they employ are not full-time employees. They're intellectual piecework.
So talk a little bit about the interplay between technology and free trade, or it's not open borders by any stretch, but mass scale immigration, because how do these things work together?
Well, I think there are a couple things that are very interesting here, and they play out with the U.S.-China relationship too. So you've got a reality that increasingly you don't need a lot of labor to produce product. Now, how did China grow? How did they get to where they are today? Globalization, right? They were the factory of the world. They had incredibly industrious, comparatively low-cost labor that were building things for a global market. Now, if you no longer need a lot of labor to produce stuff, especially when the Chinese labor's gotten more expensive and when they've got stronger companies now and there's no rule of law, why would you be making stuff in China? So the interesting thing is that whether or not you like Trump, and whether or not you think that his approach is appropriate, and I frequently do not, but I do believe that this is the right time to squeeze the Chinese because there is an orientation towards shrinking supply chains anyway. Most companies out there don't need as much labor as they have right now. And if they're going to reduce their labor, they'd like to reduce their footprint in China, not in the United States. Now, that doesn't mean more jobs are coming into the U.S., but certainly it means that more wealth and more production is coming into the U.S. And once you have that wealth, it needs to be redistributed, right? You have to find a way to make sure that you're taking care of your citizens. But if you do that, right, it seems like the Americans should be in a much better position.
You write at one point in the book, or in Us Versus Them, which, and, you know, this is merely the latest in a series of books that are kind of working over the same territory and whatnot. And we can talk about how, since the book came out last year, you update or revise or toss out certain things.
Sure.
But you write at one point that Donald Trump didn't create Us Versus Them. Us Versus Them created Donald Trump, and those who dismiss his supporters are damaging the United States. Explain that a bit.
Well, I mean, I'm not someone who believes that we should be blaming Trump for these pretty structural symptoms that have been growing over decades now, not just in the United States, but other countries. Let's remember, 2016, we had the election. Well before that, 6 months, you had Brexit, right? Same thing. An awful lot of people throwing facts to the wind and saying, I am just sick of being lied to by these establishment buffoons who they have their fancy degrees, they have their science, but I know they're not going to take care of me. And so they want me to vote against Brexit. Screw them. I'm voting for Brexit. I want to break something. This is the only way that I have a voice. And I think we should be sympathetic to that. I personally do believe that Donald Trump is the least fit for office president that we've had in my lifetime. I mean, by a long margin. I do believe that. But I also think that the question is, how did we as a country, how did we as a nation, how did we as a voting population get to the point that we would be willing to consider someone like that for the presidency? And that is not Trump's fault or responsibility. That's on us. That's on you. It's on me. It's on the
Don't be so quick to lump me into it.
Well,
but,
anyone with a voice.
Yeah.
It's on anyone who is a member of the quote-unquote establishment that has the ability to influence people either through power, money, their thoughts. And I lump myself into it. I certainly feel like people like me could have been doing more to address this issue before it got to Trump 2016.
So let's go back to talk about the, you know, one of the failures of globalism, or one of the main components of it was the United States as the, you know, the kind of peacemaker, the hegemon, yep, militarily and yep, diplomatically and yep, whatnot. In previous work, you've talked about a G0 world. I mean, that's the kind of a controlling metaphor of your work. What happens when the United States withdraws from the world stage? Or and is it an act of withdrawal, or is it just the recognition that perhaps the United States has always been more impotent as a hegemon than we wanted to believe? Because, you know, you mentioned we lost Iraq, we lost Afghanistan, but, you know, in a lot of ways, we've lost every war since World War II. And it's not exactly clear.
Grenada, come on.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true. Grenada, I was on vacation
war
that weekend,
oh,
so
yeah,
I forget
you missed
about
it. It's like I was on vacation when Steinbrenner died, and I came back and I went to a Yankees game a couple of months later, and yeah, I saw all this stuff on Steinbrenner. I'm like, what the hell? What's Steinbrenner? Why are they talking about him? Everyone's looking at me like he's dead. You miss that week,
that's right,
you just miss it.
So what, you know, how important is the decline or is the withdrawal of the United States from the world stage militarily and kind of diplomatically? And, you know, we hear a lot about the United States is necessary to enforce shipping lanes, yeah, and that, yeah, you know, if we don't have our finger in every pot, the world's just going to go to hell. Do you see this, and it's a decades long, you know, kind of process, is it an intentional thing, or is it the developing world or the non-American world, non-European world flexing its muscles?
Yeah.
What's going on with that? And how important does that trigger all of the other stuff, or are these co-equal, you know, free trade, mobility of labor, people, and military might?
I mean, it's clearly overdetermined. In other words, yeah, there are more factors than you need out right there to get you why the Americans are doing less. I mean, one you didn't mention, but is interesting, mm-hmm, is the energy revolution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the United States, yeah, now is the world's largest producer of
right
oil
we
and gas.
We don't need to be in the
we
Middle
don't
East
need
in the way
Middle
that
East
we are,
yeah,
and, we and, are remain entangled.
And oddly, I mean, you know, in Trump's best relations in the world right now are with the Israelis, the Emiratis, and the Saudis. So mm-hmm, it's kind of ironic,
right,
but clearly this is a guy that feels like we don't need to be doing as much, investing as much. And I think that that is one reason for that. I do think that some of it has been mistakes, mm-hmm, and failures by the U.S. Some of it is weakness and divisions within our allies, mm-hmm, right? Some of it is a changed world
order. So that meaning that, for instance, Europe writ large did not go all in with us in Iraq.
And that Brexit is happening,
right,
and that Europe doesn't mm-hmm know increasingly what they stand for,
right,
even if they want to be wholly European.
Mm-hmm.
There's the backlash of Euroscepticism we see across the continent today in Italy and Hungary and Poland and in Turkey and mm-hmm all of these places. I mean, Turkey doesn't feel like an American ally today.
Right.
And that's
which is
largely
really
on the Turks.
A largely kind of unacknowledged turnabout. I mean, during the Cold War, we did not have a better NATO ally than Turkey.
Correct.
And now, for a variety of reasons, including, I would argue, they're being spurned by the EU, in the way that they did.
That's
they're
right.
Kind of like, screw it, we might as well become our own kind of awful place.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue that what the EU did with Turkey is what the U.S. did with Russia, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, never let people sniff their way around a club that you have no intention of letting them in.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that with Russia and the NATO-Russia Council. We said, here, we'll show you what it might be like, but we're never going to actually
right
engage. In fact, we're going to make it more painful for
right
you. And the Europeans did the same thing with candidate membership status in mm-hmm the EU. They had no intention of letting the Turks in.
Well, the whole concept, I mean, going back 1,000 years, the concept of Europe is really built against the Turk,
sure,
you know, as a figure.
Absolutely.
So how much of this is simply then that, you know, we have a lot of mid-20th century or, you know, 20th century institutions like the EU,
yeah,
the common market, the EU, NATO, you know, a variety of other alliances as well as economic things. And they're just played out, not because anybody is particularly bad or evil or anything. But it's just, you know, in the same way, houses that are built today look different than houses that were built 100 years ago because we live differently.
Yeah. But the question is, why are they played out, mm-hmm, right? And we've gotten to a couple of those reasons. One is the weakness and divisions of allies.
Mm-hmm.
A second is the fact that the Americans feel like they don't need this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
A third is the fact the Americans have made a lot of mistakes and they've been kind of impotent. A fourth is the fact the Americans are actively withdrawing from some things.
Right.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership, they
mm-hmm
try to set it up, they fail, Trump pulls out, Paris Climate Accords,
mm-hmm,
I mean, you know, a lot of the UN architecture, and then you have the developing world, and particularly China. And you have Russia and the Russians, who are in decline and prone to break things and really mm-hmm. blame the Americans, and with some justification, mm-hmm. though not a lot.
Right, right.
And so are trying actively to lean on those divisions and expand them inside our own countries and within the transatlantic alliance. And then you have the Chinese, who are succeeding mm-hmm. with a different model. Mm-hmm. And they believe that that model is intrinsic to their success, and they are not willing to adapt it to align more with American institutions or architecture.
Although, well, two things. One, then, so do you see Russia is a declining state, China yeah. is a rising state,
correct.
America, and let's, you know, say Western Europe or OECD, NATO, whatever, and I realize these are large and different categories, but they're kind of steady state or in slow decline or kind of plateauing. Is China, Russia, I assume you do not see as a long-term threat in terms of it's going to take over the world. It's not that Russia is not the Soviet Union. This is not 1970.
They're spoilers, basically. Yeah. That's right.
Is the China model, is it ascendant, and or is China looking for global hegemony, or are they looking for a path that they can continue on where they get bigger and more influential? But you hear on a lot of conservatives in particular, and to a certain degree, there was in the Democratic Party, there was but the idea that China is the new Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Is that a category error?
I mean, I do believe that the Chinese economy will become substantially mm-hmm. larger than that of the United States. Mm-hmm. That was never true of the Soviet Union.
Right.
China is a technology superpower already, and there are many areas where they are leading the United States. And they've accomplished that in 5 years, mm-hmm. which is mind-blowing. And they certainly have the potential to outstrip us dramatically, which leads a question as to whether mm-hmm. or not we should want to destroy Huawei. Mm-hmm. And there's an argument for it, right? I mean, if we know that these guys are building an alternative that works, we kind of need to tell our allies, you can't use that.
Is that because it just transfers too much economic power, or is it because, you know, they're building in all kinds of trapdoors and backdoors so that the Chinese government is able to do what the United States government is probably able to do now in terms of, spying and technological surveillance?
I mean, I think some of it is the fact that it's economic power that's linked to the state. Mm-hmm. I mean, economic power in the private sector is not really a threat to the United States. Economic power where the government wields it and uses that to align governments politically towards a hub and spoke relationship mm-hmm. with Beijing and a new quote unquote consensus that feels hegemonic is a direct threat mm-hmm. to the US and its allies. And then you have the issues of malware, spying, mm-hmm. controlling data, controlling standards, controlling the architecture mm-hmm. that underpins anything that has a chip in it, the mm-hmm. Internet of Things. All of which is fundamentally threatening to a global free market model. I mean, you know, Reason talks about free minds and free markets. Well, I mean, a China-led world has neither of those.
Right.
So fundamentally threatening. I mean, you asked at the beginning, you talked about how the wonderful story is that we've created all this wealth. And so we've got a global middle class now. Agree. On the other hand, let us recognize that even if the US had a great relationship with China, and we don't, not even close, but even if we did, the idea that the world's most powerful economy is going to, in short order, be middle income, authoritarian, and state capitalist mm-hmm. means that global governance will deteriorate mm-hmm. dramatically. Not their fault. Mm-hmm. I'm not blaming them. It's just a reality. So the idea that we should just be brazenly optimistic because of globalization is insane,
yeah.
right? It's great for the wealth of individual people. It's horrible for global governance because this wonderful moment of, say, 75 years where the countries that had most of the power were the ones that also had most of the wealth and therefore the luxury of being able to think about a proper social contract and mm-hmm. second and third order liberties for people and, you know, even dealing more effectively with the planet. And Lord knows we've had our, mm-hmm. you know, hypocrisies around that. But the Chinese will be much worse. And they'll mm-hmm. be worse because they have to be, because they just haven't made it to that level of Maslow's hierarchy, mm-hmm. right? And I think people don't understand how dramatic that shift is going to be for the world.
Do you think that China can maintain their growth if they remain authoritarian. And this is, you know, that Milton Friedman, among others, have posited. And, you know, and this could well be embedded in a kind of Western fantasy, a kind of rights-based fantasy that in order to get economic growth, you have to have a certain amount of economic liberalism. The minute that you grant people economic liberalism, they start making money, then they start demanding political freedom. We're talking, you know, right around the anniversary of Tiananmen Square, which was seen as an early indicator of that. You know, the Chinese economy was liberalized a little after Mao. People started clamoring for rights. Is that a fantasy?
I mean, it's certainly a desire.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh, it's a projection.
It's a projection. Sure. Yeah, yeah. You know, so one way of thinking about that is, if the United States were to become dramatically less open and liberal than it is today, and it already has become somewhat,
we're under a new regime of protectionism and closing borders. I mean, we're supposedly somewhere, you know, everybody's building a border somewhere. Right?
So, we think that's going to really decrease productivity inside the United States? And I'm not sure, because we talked about the fact that supply chains are going to shrink.
Right.
We talked about the fact that the global capitalist model is changing in part because capital and labor are becoming disintermediated by technology. So that's one reason why this might not be as close to the Friedman ideal as it had been when he posited it. Then you have the reality that technology 25 years ago, when the internet was really in its heyday created, was all about the individual. It was all about access for the individual.
Right. Disintermediation was the cri de coeur of the early internet.
Right.
We don't need all of these middlemen, and things can decentralize and disperse. And the whole point of a network was that you had this wide range of individuals who could connect directly to each other.
Right, which is no longer the case. What we have now is everyone's connected, but what the data is surveilled and is aggregated and is monetized by a very small number of gatekeepers who make an extraordinary amount of money. Now, that is good for the private sector in the U.S. if you happen to sit on top of those pyramids like Google and Facebook and Amazon do, but it's also good for the Chinese. And, you know, what we see today is that technology may be the most insidious driver of tribalism in liberal democracies in the world. It also facilitates an authoritarian model in China. And I don't know how long that continues, right? But I do think it would be foolish of us not to believe that the Chinese government, authoritarian government, state capitalist government, has more wind in its sails and has a longer lease on life and growth because of what technology today does and what they can do with it. So at the very least, if we're talking about 10, 20 years, I would bet fairly heavily that China doesn't collapse. And not just because they've had 40 years of success, and so the people are pretty patriotic and they don't have a lot of internal divisions, but also because this technology control really matters for them, that they have the ability to help channel people into the types of decisions, unifying decisions, that they think are good for political stability.
Can you compare that? You write a lot about India, and compare that a little with India, which, you know, is, I guess, if it hasn't, will overtake China's the most populous country. It's certainly the most populous democracy, and it has very much of an us versus them split in it. Is India then, is in kind of the way you're describing things, India is really hampered by being a democracy?
India is hampered by being so decentralized, certainly.
Although it's bizarre, right? Because on the one hand, within recent memory in India, every economic decision had to be run up all the way to the top of the government.
But it doesn't get implemented.
But yeah.
Yeah. And massive corruption at the local level. And one thing Modi has tried very hard to do is break through that. And he's had some success, and growth has been picking up in part as a consequence. But Modi's ability to drive growth, I mean, India today with 1.4 billion people, just like China, actually invests 1/10 the amount in infrastructure that China does. And they're not only catching up, they're losing massive ground to the Chinese every day. That gap is growing. It's growing dramatically. It's growing in defense. It's growing in technology. It's growing in infrastructure. It's growing in wealth. It's growing in global footprint. And so, I mean, I think the big story about India today is how it is that they continue to massively underperform China, despite all of their talent and despite their democracy.
In a certain way, the way that you're talking about Trump, he seems to be, he was conjured. He's not the person who made this world, but he was kind of conjured up by it. But it sounds like you think he's basically, regardless of personal style and all of that, he's basically making the right choices in this. You were saying, this is a good time to squeeze China. I didn't say it's a good time to leave Paris or
TPP. For example, it's a good time to squeeze China, but I would much rather be squeezing China with American allies.
Yeah.
I would much rather not be launching a trade war with the Mexicans
right.
at the same time that I'm squeezing the Chinese. I would rather have the Europeans on our side on 5G,
right?
On technology. It's critical. So, I think that Trump's transactionalism and unilateralism, which comes in part from his narcissism, means that he really doesn't do long-term strategy. And that in a system that already doesn't do long-term strategy mm-hmm. very well. And that's a serious problem. And it's particularly serious problem because he doesn't develop good relations with other leaders around the world who also have very healthy egos.
Well, except Kim Jong-un, right?
It doesn't seem that Kim Jong-un relationship
They might
be great.
They're friendly, but he really hasn't gotten in his pants yet.
I think that is a safe, if rather visual metaphor.
What is the appeal from a kind of political science point of view, or from a kind of psychographic point of view? What's the appeal of tariffs? Because every economist will tell you, and most people understand that if China isn't paying the tariffs. Mexico, if they get implemented, Mexico is not paying the tariffs. American consumers and American businesses are paying the tariffs. What's the appeal of laying tariffs? And Trump, talking, kind of like a 19th century politician a while ago, declared that I am a tariff man.
Well, to be clear, tariffs are usually paid by both sides.
Mm-hmm.
So when you levy a 10 or a 25% tariff on the Chinese, the Chinese companies can pass that all on to the consumers. And if they do it, those consumers are more likely to find other places to buy. Mm-hmm. So usually you meet in the middle. Okay. And usually some of the cost is borne by the Chinese and some of the cost is borne by the Americans. Now, the Americans do not need China as much as China needs the United States. We have a bigger mm-hmm. economy and we are not as dependent on our international imports.
Does this explain why, and I think it's probably oversold because it involves Elon Musk, so we know there's a huge amount of Barnumism going on there,
but
the idea that Tesla was going to be opening a factory in China where it would maintain its IP and intellectual property in a way that typically does not. I mean, are there signs that China is willing to meet, if not in the middle, at least negotiate things?
There are signs that the Chinese really don't want a trade war with the U.S. because it's going to hurt their economy a lot. Mm. There are also signs that they are willing to give the Americans some things in return for that. There are signs that the Chinese recognize not only that IP theft has gotten to the point that they are starting to raise real ire among Western quote-unquote partners, but also that the Chinese are world leaders in some technology, so they're going to need some level of IP protection for their own private sector participants. But if you ask me, does all of that amount to a deal that will create what we would consider to be a level playing field on market access? No. Again, mm-hmm. go back to Huawei.
Yeah.
If Amazon and Google and Facebook cannot have market access to the Chinese, why should we provide market access to Huawei in the United mm-hmm. States? I think that's an interesting question, right? And historically, the answer would be, well, because we're a lot bigger and because we'll make money from being able to compete against weaker economies, weaker technology. But if Huawei is, grabbing that data, a national security menace, and they're rolling out 5G faster and cheaper than the West is, in part because of their state subsidies, then, the only reason you wouldn't destroy them is because you fear that the Chinese are going to hit you back so hard that you can't handle it.
Hmm.
But, I have to tell you that if you want to be honest about it, this is a fundamental structural problem for the Americans and our allies that's going to get worse. And one of the only reasons I don't think we should destroy him, frankly, is because I don't think Trump can execute on it. I don't think he'll get our allies on board suitably. I think he'll fail.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the idea that this is a big problem. We need to hit them as a consequence. I think it's probably right.
Yeah. What would be your preferred answer that would be different than Trump's then in terms of mobility of people around the world or access to the United States, not necessarily as a market, but as a place to live and work?
Well, one thing that Trump has fundamentally right is we should be changing immigration, focusing more on skill set and the labor that we need and less on everybody, you know, sort of comes in blind to that, because mm-hmm. the fact is we just don't need that level of low and mid capability labor the way we used to.
And do you see it as necessarily it's disruptive when you say we don't need, I'm not, you know,
Germans don't need, the Americans don't need, Japanese okay. do.
Well, I guess even right. with, yeah, certainly, but even within the United States, we're seeing declining birth rates or fertility rates. And do individuals have a right to show up someplace, not necessarily to get welfare or to, you know, be welcomed with parades, but why does it hurt to have more open borders rather than, you know, less open borders?
I certainly believe in the Statue of Liberty. My grandmother from Aleppo, Syria, an Armenian, came to Ellis Island, and her name's on one of the benches. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that system. Right. But I also understand, given the backlash that we've seen over the past decades, and given how broken the social contract presently is, that we are going to need to shift simply because of political reality. Mm-hmm. I mean, under Reagan, we closed the borders for a while with Mexico and food prices went up because we didn't have Mexicans that were willing to pick the produce. We increasingly don't need that level of labor to pick mm-hmm. the produce in the U.S. So you're not going to have the same level of economic necessity that drives it. And that is a compelling argument for immigration. When you take it away, I mean, when all the Syrians come into Germany and they don't have the skill set to actually integrate and work in the labor force, it creates a lot more backlash against right. Merkel. Now,
that's also a very different question, right? I mean, because people are leaving Syria because of a civil war,
right.
which, you know, the United States, along with, you could say, Europe, you know, is implicated in
yes.
to a greater or lesser degree.
Sure.
People coming from Central America, people coming from Asia into the United States are not, they're not refugees, they're not asylees. And they tend to-
from Honduras.
Yeah, well-
You would make that argument. Yeah, Guatemala. I mean, I think that
El
there are
Salvador,
people that are legitimately
yeah. Yeah,
seeking
who are
asylum.
Also, you know, I mean, fleeing in another way from, you know, I would argue they're fleeing from the, you know, the remnants or forces put in place of U.S. intervention
right.
from 20
absolutely.
Or 30 years ago.
Absolutely. And those people are absolutely the big numbers we're seeing right. in the U.S. right now. It's yeah. not Mexicans.
Right.
It's not Mexicans.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So it's a very similar point.
They incorporate fairly well into the economy over time.
They do over know, time. Yeah. But what I am saying is I am empathetic
right.
to the political reality that an awful lot of Americans are simply not prepared to accept that kind of argument when we haven't right. taken care of them.
Yeah.
I would rather us have a more open border system. I would rather, because we're the wealthiest economy in the world, I want us to lead by example. Mm. I want us to be a country where not only does everybody think that this is how they want to live themselves, but that we're more welcome to the people that truly like fight to get over here, because mm-hmm. we're going to have a diverse set of ideas and values, mm-hmm. and that's going to make our country the most extraordinary, most vibrant, most entrepreneurial place in the world. I'm all over it. But I'm telling you, in the same way that I'm sympathetic for why people decided mm-hmm. to break things and vote for Brexit, break things and vote for Trump, I'm sympathetic to sure. the idea that a lot of Americans have said no mas mm-hmm. on this stuff. And I think we have to address that first. I think we do.
So how do we address that with, because in reading your work broadly, I feel like I'm reminded of the way Joseph Schumpeter talked about the way capitalism ends, not through Marxist immiseration of the working
creative
class, which then creates, but through that creative destruction yeah. becomes so disruptive that you create an intellectual class that once managed capitalism or socialism, that individuals just, you know, I started out as a dry cleaner and then I went into 24-hour photography development. And now, you know, 5 years later, I'm driving Uber like I can't take it anymore. How do you deal with this? How do you reintegrate a world so that people buy into, if not an American dream, but a sense that they're going to end up better off than they started?
I think it's hard. I think, you know, we've seen books that show that whatever the political system, gatekeepers want to make sure that they still have access and their kids have even better access. Mm-hmm. And that this book that was written by this Princeton economic historian, The Great Levelers, mm-hmm. says that, you know, historically, the only way that you actually reduce inequality in societies over time is famine, war, and revolution.
Right. Medicare for all is not going to do it.
Yeah, I don't want those three things in the United States. Now, I mean, there are exceptions, and it's not all a straight line. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that our government, top down, is not close to addressing and resolving this. And I worry about that mm-hmm. because remember when we had a Great Depression in this country, we tried first to say, well, the government can't do it. Herbert Hoover, let's have the private sector. It'll be trickle down. And it didn't work.
Well, I would disagree with that. I mean, Hoover actually increased federal spending, et cetera. But your point is taken. And we tried a lot of different things and none of it worked until after World War II in terms of actual economic growth and getting off of rationing and all of this kind of stuff.
So do I think a Green New Deal is going to do it for the Americans? No, I don't think it's passable. I think it'd be very wasteful. But I do think we have to spend a lot on infrastructure in this mm-hmm. country, in poorer parts of the country. I do think we need to invest in universal lifetime training. Mm-hmm. And we have to do it for the working and middle classes. We have to. We're not close to that.
Yeah. And do you have confidence that the government can do that?
Not near term. Yeah. I mean, I do over time. But I think in the near term, what we're going to need are smaller scale experiments that prove that they can work and they're mm-hmm. scalable. And some of those will be private sector driven. Mm-hmm. Some of those will be state driven, city driven. Mm-hmm. We're going to need a lot of them, though. And why do I talk about it? Why do I write the book I wrote? Is because I'm hoping that that will move the needle a little bit.
Briefly, two points that I want to touch. First, describe your own life kind of trajectory. You mentioned in the book and in other writings that you grew up in projects. You ended up with a PhD from Stanford.
Yeah.
So how did that happen? And what were your intellectual markers along the way? What school of thought do you come out of?
You know, my mother was, she raised me and my brother by herself. My dad died when I was four. He was an enlisted man in the Army. And my mother was a homemaker who dropped out of high school. And I was raised in Boston where her family was. So there was a support mechanism. So the projects in Chelsea, just outside mm-hmm. of Boston. And I mean, I was safe. It was just poor. Mm-hmm. But the point is that you don't have opportunities there. You don't meet the kind of people. You don't have the kind of mentors that will be able to get you into the places you need to get. And it was purely because my mother was extraordinary. Mm. She spent her entire life doing everything possible to give opportunities to her kids and make her two kids feel like they could get something done. And as a consequence, I got my PhD at Stanford. My brother went to Harvard undergrad mm-hmm. and our other friends from the projects are still back in Chelsea. Mm-hmm. I also write in the book, my brother voted for Trump. Mm-hmm. And if my mother was still alive today, no way she's voting for Hillary because mm-hmm. she used to read the National Enquirer every week. Her view was these people are lying.
Right.
They're not going to take care of my kids.
And that's true. We know this to be true.
We know this. And so, I mean, I think that my mother had a deeper truth. And I think one mm-hmm. of the reasons I'm so sympathetic, or at least I'm empathetic to the people that are voting for Trump, and I don't consider them deplorables, is mm-hmm. because I come from that. And I get that anger. I get the fact that you don't blame people when the system is rigged against them. You mm-hmm. can't blame those people. Right. And you can't say, well, they don't know what they want. Well, of course, they know, but they're angry. Legitimately angry.
In the current situation, then, who on the Democratic side do you think is most likely to tap into that empathy?
Well, I mean, Bernie is tapping into that empathy, and you can see it with the young people who have vastly more support for him than they do for Biden. I think, generally speaking, the far left is more engaged in that way. And the mm-hmm. young people, the people like Buttigieg who come from, mm-hmm. he's seven years old. I think that is but really it's AOC who's not mm-hmm. running.
Right.
But she's by far the most popular and she's by mm-hmm. far the most tapped into this.
And the most polarizing.
And the most, is she more polarizing than Bernie? I don't know. Yeah. But she is polarizing and she's also
charismatic. She's like Trump. They're polarizing. They stress the riggedness of the system.
Yes, they stress the riggedness. Now, I mean, Trump actually has a cabinet which is even more swampy than we had under Obama or Bush. I think if AOC were president, she would not. So I think it is important to recognize that. But I take your point.
And then finally, just you have a PBS series called G-Zero World. What do you hope to accomplish with that? And, you know, when's the best time to watch it?
I want people to be less crazy about politics. Mm-hmm. I see how angry people get, how divisive politics has become. You watch CNN or MSNBC or Fox, or you watch your social media feed, and you want to throw your phone through the window, right? Mm-hmm. It makes people angry. It makes people insane. And I'm not angry. I'm not angry. I'm just not an angry person. I take my work seriously. I don't take myself that seriously. And I've never been a part of a political party. I have no interest in doing so. And so G-Zero World, I mean, we even have puppets, right? Of Trump, of Kim Jong-un, of AOC, of Elizabeth Warren, you name it. And it's lighthearted, but it's educational. And so I'm trying to break through to people that know that politics is important, but don't want to go insane. And if I can make them 10% less crazy, 10% less crazy about the world, and maybe a little bit more engaged, that's my goal. So I was on Charlie Rose's last show, and after his show was gone, I realized I didn't have a smart place to go and talk for foreign affairs for half an hour anymore. And so I figured I had to do it. And they can watch it on pretty much any PBS station around the world. They can watch it on pretty much any PBS station around the country. But it is different listings at different times, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah.
And they can watch it also on gzeromedia.com.
Okay. We'll leave it. We didn't get to talk about your retracted tweet that where you faked the quote from
Trump. I would have done that.
But I think you've done that through the whole show. It's an interesting thing. There's nothing more to be said about that. Ian Bremmer of G-Zero World, of Us Versus Them, of Eurasia Group, thanks for talking to Reason.
Great to talk to you, man. See you.
This has been the Reason Podcast. Thanks for listening.